Okay, I want to welcome everybody here, and I want to thank Mark Tess for helping to organize the office, the firm, and the lunch.
Yep.
And this was, you know, a last-minute thing, so we're happy you can make it. Just very briefly, Michael Broyd is a professor of law at Emory University in Atlanta. He's on the law and religion program. He runs the program there. He's a dayan in the Beit Din of America, the largest in Jewish court. He's published widely on areas of law, of secular law, Jewish law, and the interaction between Jewish and secular law. And he'll be talking today on perjury, client perjury, and Jewish law. So,
thank you.
Without further ado, thank you.
So I'm going to start with some confessions, because confessions are important in conversations about client perjury. The first is that I know no Canadian law. None at all. I know a considerable amount of the good old-fashioned common law and quite a bit of American law and quite a bit of American legal ethics, but when you stop me and ask me what's the law here, the honest answer is I don't know. So I'm hoping you can start by telling me the answer to a couple of hypotheticals. Client comes in and is accused of a felony that's violent. And he tells you that he did it, and it was really him who committed the assault, but he's got a twin brother who looks identical to him, and he wants to say on the stand it wasn't him, but it was his twin brother. How do you respond as a lawyer to the client's acknowledgement that he wants to commit perjury on the stand? Can somebody help me?
No, I don't know that. Can't take a contrary position to what your client told you under oath.
No, you can't put him in the stand.
You can't put him in the stand. Okay, fine.
You know he's doing a lie.
Yeah, you can't put him in the
stand. Right. So your client, having told you that it's him, is it prohibited for him to take the stand, or is it merely prohibited for you to represent him?
No, not take the stand. You still represent him.
Uh-huh. And when he says, I wish to testify? And how are you obligated to stop him?
You don't get him on the stand.
He says, excuse me, I wish to take the stand.
You've got to resign.
Oh, so when so the answer to this question is, if your client insists on committing perjury, you must cease representing him in the face of his perjury. That's the answer that Canadian law requires. You can't just not represent him during his perjurious moments. You have to cease representing him in total. Do you have to tell the judge why you are ceasing to represent him?
No.
No.
You're not allowed to.
Are you not allowed to, or?
You're not allowed to.
And presumably, no other lawyer can then undertake to represent him if he acknowledges the falseness of what he wishes to undertake.
Effectively, he's going to go to the next lawyer and not tell
him. I got that. Effectively, he's going to learn his lesson. I understand this. When he takes the stand and does commit perjury, you are not allowed to, I'm guessing, breach your attorney-client relationship and testify that he confessed to the contrary to you. So your attorney-client relationship is strong enough to prevent you from revealing the truth as you know it, but doesn't permit you to represent him. Okay? Let's take the next case, so I just want to know roughly where the law settles on you. A client comes to you and proposes that he sign a false affidavit in the future. Can you represent him through that activity? Is that considered the same as perjury, the commissioning of a false affidavit, and presumably representing a client while they're committing tax fraud is the same thing as well? A client comes to you and says, I'm considering this tax fraud. Can you tell me the likelihood of being caught? Client comes to you and says, I have a tax fraud here. I know it's illegal. I'm not interested in your opinion as to whether it's a crime or not. I'm interested in your opinion on the likelihood of prosecution.
I think you could give that answer because you're not assisting him with the tax fraud.
You can advise him as to the criminality.
tell you?
He knows it's criminal. He wants to know, is it detectable?
One never knows the answer.
No, but he's asking you for your best opinion. Of course, you never know for sure, but clients come to you asking for your best advice. Can you give him your best advice, which is this fraud is not commonly detected?
This is in advance of him doing it, or?
This is in advance of him doing it because he wishes not to do frauds that are detected. Most criminals wish not to get caught. I'll just note.
Yeah, counsel somebody to commit a fraud.
So I'm asking you a client crime conduct. The client says, "Do I wish to commit crime X? I know it's a crime. I wish to know though whether this is a crime that's easily detected. Can you give me your professional opinion as to whether this crime is readily detected? And if detected, what's the penalty?" Can you lie to him and say, no, this crime is always detected in order to deter him from committing the crime? Okay. Would it be proper to lie to this client and say, yes, this crime is frequently detected. You should stay away from it when in truth you know this crime is never detected. Can somebody help me with that case?
He wouldn't sue you for
I got it.
You don't think you can lie to the client?
You don't think you can lie to the
client?
Even to deter a client from committing a crime?
Well, it depends what kind of client.
What kind of client or what kind of crime? Right, he comes to you, you look at this tax fraud and you say, wow, this guy's really good. They're never going to catch him. You can say to him, wow, that's really good. They're never going to catch you. Is that true?
No.
Okay, so... So you've looked at his fraud, you conclude that this is a really excellent, well-done fraud, and never in a million years will they catch him. What are you supposed to say to him?
I think you say they'll never catch you, but your duty isn't done if you stop there. You go on and say this is a crime, and you shouldn't be doing it, and we have ways of helping you confess and make good.
And to which he says, thank you so much. No, he doesn't say not interested. He said, thank you so much for your honest advice, and I appreciate the final comment as well. Of course. He doesn't say to you, and of course I'm going to go commit the crime. He says, thank you for your opinion. I won't get caught. Of course I won't do it, whether he does or he doesn't.
Is he going to send him a bill that says tax advice? I'd never do that. Or tax their...
Well, would you send him a bill, though?
Well, you got. I think it's A, you'd have to document very well what you discussed with him, and then you warn him not to do it.
That's right. Meaning
but
you could.
B, I don't see that. If it's professionally appropriate, why can't you do it?
No, I'm
going
to do it. I'm sure we'll tell tax advice.
Okay, or consultation on a criminal violation. You can call it whatever you want. But I just want to note that answer is the standard American law answer as well, which says when a client comes to you with a prospective crime, which he wants you as an attorney to evaluate for detectability. That's what the client wants. The client knows you worked for many years as an IRS examiner, and then as an appellate attorney for the IRS, and you're intimately familiar with the government rules and the government process, and he thinks he's found a way to commit, let's make a case very simple, tax fraud, you are allowed to look at his fraud and say, this is a crime. You should not do this. And if he says to you, well, if I do it, what is the likelihood of my being detected? You're allowed to answer that question honestly. And in the United States, you're allowed to send him a bill, although your consideration, which says you don't write on the bill tax fraud advice, probably sounds awfully prudent. But even if, in fact, he's a government agent running an undercover sting, notwithstanding that fact, you're protected so long as you start the conversation by saying, this conduct is illegal, you should not do it. And you're allowed to do that within the United States. Contemporary states differ about your, what you sweetly called the double barrel case, which is, what do you do when the client comes in and doesn't say tax fraud? He says, I'm in a very bad marriage, and I've developed a way to kill my spouse. Can I please run it by you so that you can tell me whether I'll get caught? We're going to go on a boating trip. It's going to, well, I'm not going to describe to you the homicide. It's not important. Here, American legal ethics pushes in two very different directions. One set of rules say that when your client proposes a prospective violent crime, you are duty-bound to breach your attorney-client ethical obligation of confidence and not only advise the client to stop, but acknowledge that if the client looks like he's proceeding, you can breach your attorney-client relationship and take what steps are necessary to deter the violent crime. It's only violent crime and not financial crime. That's exactly correct. There are some gray cases at the tip of the two, but really the line is fairly clearly drawn between violent crime and financial crime, although the gray area involves financial crime that's customarily accompanied by violence, even if this is not. Like loan sharking. Is loan sharking a financial crime? Okay, so there's an ongoing American law dispute about loan sharking where the threat of non-repayment is accompanied by the threat of violence. Please.
The magnitude at all involved? So like if Bernie Madoff ran through his scheme with you before committing it?
So there is no state now that permits the breaching of a heinous financial crime other than making the following rationale, which you'll find said in law reviews. Certain financial crimes are of the magnitude that they endanger people's lives. So the this way, which is stealing $100,000 is different than stealing $100 million, and when you're taking away the pension from widows and orphans, they will freeze to death, and this is like endangering their life. But to the best of my knowledge, not a single state endorses that rationale. Some states say when your client threatens a double-barreled crime, you have to breach. And other states say when a client threatens a double-barreled crime, you may but need not breach. When it comes to prospective client perjury, American law is a little bit different than what you described. In the United States, when a client says to you he wishes to go on the stand and commit perjury, you need not cease representing the client. You only need to cease representing the client during the perjurer statement. Which is a much bigger tip-off, if you think about it, that the client is committing perjury. When I was clerking, for example.
Yes, that was yesterday in The Good Wife. My wife was watching. watching exactly what happened, and in the middle of it, when the guy perjures himself, the lawyer has to say, pursuant to my professional ethics, right? I mean, the tip-off.
So I will tell you, the only time I ever saw this, when I was clerking in Newark, the judge said, go in and watch this trial. In the middle of this trial, the attorney says, Your Honor, I have to go to the bathroom urgently, and my client will continue to talk while I'm in the men's room. Don't worry. I'll come back shortly when he's finished with this line of conversation. Have a good day, Your Honor. And the client continues to speak. The lawyer runs to the bathroom. I don't really know where he ran to. And when the client finished this line of reasoning, the lawyer came back into the courtroom, visibly drying his hands, so as to assure the client that he really had gone to the bathroom. And then he turns to the judge and says, Your Honor, my client has finished his line of reasoning, and I'm back. Let's go on. A classical tip-off that you'd have to be dense not to miss, what they call in the literature of the United States a noisy withdrawal. You'd have to be incredibly naive to think that a lawyer would say, my client's going to continue to testify while I'm in the bathroom. It's okay. And when that does happen, even if you don't know what's going on, you'd naturally turn to somebody and say, explain to me what just happened, to which the answer is,
it's a legal fiction,
100%. We do not require withdrawal in the face of client perjury. We only require withdrawal from the perjurer's statements. And indeed, if you look at a client interrogatory in the United States, interrogatories frequently are numbered and have an attestation by the client on the bottom, followed by an attestation by the lawyer. You'll occasionally see attestations which say, I, the client, verify the truthfulness of all of this information. And below this, you'll see a lawyer attestation which says, I verify the truth of all of the information other than 17, 23, and 42, whose truthfulness I will not verify. Because in the United States, you're allowed to participate in a legal proceeding so long as you exclude yourself from the perjurer's statements. It's a quite amazing system, because it really, it's designed through and through to do something that what you're describing the Canadian system is not doing, which is it virtually requires that the lawyer tip the judge off to the fact that perjury is taking place through the process of, Your Honor, I'm not going to vouch for that, which is found in paragraph 17. Please look at paragraph 17 closely. Halacha, Jewish law, has always had this very complicated interaction with client perjury. And I want to use it as a stepping back to focus on a more general problem of Jewish law, which is what Jewish law calls the problem of assisting. In American law, and the model penal code particularly, and really in intellectual theory, you can think about assisting as one of two ways. You can say assisting in a crime is like the crime itself, or you can say assisting in a crime is a separate and independent crime. Jewish law is caught very intensely in this dispute. When somebody comes to me and says, I'll give you the prototypical American case, but you don't have it here because you have rigorous gun control. Somebody says, the Second Amendment of the United States allows me to own a handgun. I'd like to buy a handgun. Can you recommend to me a handgun suitable for shooting my spouse? I'm a handgun owner. I'm a handgun shop. I sell handguns to all who come in. What am I obligated to say? Someone to tell me? You want to make the case Canadian? I step in and I go to a sporting goods shop and I say, I'm looking for a baseball bat. I wish to beat somebody. I wish to beat somebody. Is that what you have to say? What do you? By the way, saying our guns are not made for killing people sounds silly. Maybe you could say our bats are not made for killing people.
They're not made for murdering people. He's in life. So nobody would sell him the gun. But it's like.
Is that true? You don't think most sporting goods store owners would say.
After hearing that,
that's right. Would say, I'm so sorry, I can't sell you a bat? Tell me why. In America, for sure. So they'd ask, they'd make recommendations based on the hardness of the bat and the softness of the wife, for sure. But the question is, what's the right results here? Somebody comes into your sporting goods store and is looking for a baseball bat to hit people with.
I mean, I don't know American law, but could that be construed as part of a conspiracy?
Is that part of a conspiracy? What do you think? I'm certainly not advertising my bat as suitable for hitting people.
Somebody says, you know, provide me with a means.
Provide me with a means to commit a crime, albeit a completely, your part of the crime is completely lawful. What do you think? You want to help me? Jewish law in the 1500s drives itself nuts over this question. It becomes a huge, fundamental, ethical and legal dispute about whether I bear a responsibility in that situation, and if so, what is my responsibility? Everybody agrees that if I sell baseball bats, and you buy my baseball bat and beat somebody with it, I'm without any culpability at all, because I say, look, I sell baseball bats to hit baseballs. Am I aware of the fact that you can use a baseball bat to hit people? For sure, but I can't restrict baseball bats. No different than a hammer salesman can't be responsible for all the uses of the hammer. But what about once I know? I know, the reason why I know is because you told me. You told me I'm going to use this bat for a crime. Or somebody turns to you and says, I'd like to buy a house. I'm buying this house to run a brothel. It's well suited for a brothel. It's at just the right corner. Has many different bedrooms. It's hard to see in. The hallway is perfectly designed. I don't know what a brothel hallway looks like. Let the tape reflect that fact. But I assume that there's a brothel design that's appropriate for a brothel and inappropriate. This house is well laid out for a brothel. Can you do the house closing?
I mean, I know that. Is there a crime in the criminal code of Canada? Aiding and abetting.
Absolutely. And what does it require? Does aiding and abetting require... Does it require any legal act by the aider and abetter? An illegal act. I step into a taxi and I say, taxi, can you take me to the First Bank of Canada? I'm going to rob it. Can my taxi driver take me to the First Bank of Canada?
The illegal act might be the mens rea of knowing that it's participation in some criminal conduct.
So when I say to my taxi driver, I'm going to rob the First Bank of Canada, can you take me there? And he takes me there, he's become an aider and abettor to bank robbery. So this topic bothers Jewish law very intensely. It produces three schools of thought that really run for centuries with no good resolution. One is Maimonides' answer. Maimonides says, as you said, and perhaps as you said as well, that aiding and abetting, the mens rea necessary for aiding and abetting occurs through your knowledge of the impropriety, even though what you are doing is totally and completely innocent. I'm just a taxi driver. The guy stepped into my taxi and he said, take me to the First Bank of Canada. That's my job. I took him to the First Bank of Canada. From the fact that he said, I'm going to rob it, doesn't matter one way or another, because my lawful job is to drive people around. Maimonides says, the two of you said, no, that's aiding and abetting. And even though many other people could do it, and there's no inherent impropriety in the fact, once I know the person is going to do a wrong, my participating in any way in assisting him is the wrong called aiding and abetting. Please.
Yeah, but isn't that because the fabric of Jewish law is woven through with morality?
Right.
And here, sure, everybody would say from a moral point of view, you shouldn't do it, shouldn't try. But
why?
We're talking about, well, because, you know, he might really do that, to kill his wife or rob the bank.
Right.
So I shouldn't have any part of that from a moral perspective. But we're looking at Canadian or U.S. law, which cuts moral out of it. It's a question of technically, are you culpable or not?
So I guess that I don't perceive Canadian law so immoral. I don't know any of it. I doubt it's even amoral. But Maimonides' point goes as follows. The culpability of aiding and abetting is, the bell is rung when you do a neutral act aware of the fact that there are criminal consequences. Maimonides' exact point is the same point the two of you averred was the Canadian view, which is, when I drive a person to the First Bank of Canada for $20 Canadian, knowing that he's going to rob the bank, I'm now an aider and abettor of a bank robbery because I knew what he's going to do. Not I approved, but I knew. And presumably, by the way, doing a house closing for a brothel, assuming running a brothel is a crime in Canada, certainly a violation of Jewish law, I assume it's a crime in Canada as well. Doing a house closing, once you know that the person who's buying the house, they said to you, I'm buying the house to run a brothel, would you please do the house closing for me? That too was a violation. That's exactly Maimonides' view, that the aiding and abetting statute is rung by the knowledge of the crime from the side of a person who's a participant. And certainly Maimonides says, I'm running a baseball supply store, and in comes Joe and says, I don't really like baseball, but I hear these are good things to beat people with. Can I buy a suitable bat for swinging at a person? And you can't say, oh, the Louisville Slugger over there, that's just the right size bat for a person of your heft. You have to say, I'm so sorry, I can't sell you a bat. Now, Maimonides critics argue that Maimonides' rule is wrong for two reasons, they say. One, you touched on. I go into my baseball store and I say I'd like to buy a bat suitable for killing somebody. My store owner says what? My Maimonidean store owner, what does he say? I'm so sorry, I can't sell to you. So what do I do? I walk out of the baseball store and I go down the block to the next sporting goods store. I step in and say, I'm looking for a baseball bat. I got a kid in Little League. What's the right size baseball bat for him? The first thing they argue is Maimonides' rule accomplishes zero. Nothing. It doesn't stop crime. It doesn't deter crime. It doesn't do anything. And the second thing they argue is it punishes who? The store owner. The only good guy in the program is punished because he loses the sale of a baseball bat. And who gets it? The other guy. And this is the view by Rabbi Moshe Isserles, the Ramah. It follows one of my favorite Jewish law rules, which I informally call only the good die young, which is you don't want to set up legal rules that punish good people and transfer business to bad people. Rabbi Isserles says as follows. If your conduct is innocent and you're not contributing in a way that is sinful, then the fact that you're participating in a wrong without doing any wrong yourself does not make you culpable in any way, shape, or form. The aiding and abetting statute is only triggered by you're doing something that is criminal on your part.
But I mean, you could take the opposite position and say there shouldn't be a positive duty on people when they've got knowledge of an intended criminal act to take some sort of action.
Absolutely. Now, Rabbi Isserlis, in fact, says, the Ramah says, that you do have that duty of disclosure, but only if that duty of disclosure will be effective. Frequently, if you disclose in this situation, no crime has yet occurred. Client comes to me and says, I'd like to buy this house as a brothel. So I can't really disclose because no crime has yet been committed and there's nothing to disclose. So I have only one of two choices. I can either close on the house for my client, get my closing fee and walk away, or say what? I can't close for you because you told me you're going to run a brothel, in which case my client does what?
Goes
to him. Right, goes down the block and says, excuse me, I'd like to buy this architecturally interesting house. It has so many nice bedrooms and so many nice halls. I'm thinking of running a museum. And nobody is well served by this charade because none of us, I can't call up the police and say so-and-so is thinking of buying a house to run a brothel because why? So far there's not even been a crime. It's hard to believe. The police don't know how to respond to a phone call by a lawyer saying, I've got a client who's interested in buying a house to run a brothel.
But if he says, I want to buy a house for purposes of kidnapping and torturing people, I mean, I think, like Aaron said, that's a different...
So again, let's think this through. So my client says, I'd like to buy this house because it's got a deep sub-basement. I can hide people in the sub-basement as I torture and kill them. Okay, so I say to my client, my gosh, that's a terrible thing to do. I will not represent you. Now what happens?
Goes to another lawyer.
What does he say to the other lawyer? I'd like to buy this house. Can you breach now what this man said to you and go to the police?
No, there's no imminent harm to a specific person.
So the Canadian system has done the following. It's prevented the lawyer from doing an impropriety, but has increased not one whit the likelihood that the harm gets caught. The Canadian model says you can't facilitate this activity. But you know what you can't do? Prevent it in any way, shape, or form. Client comes to you and says, I want to buy this house with this deep basement because I'm going to capture and kill people and torture them in the basement. You say, oh my gosh, I can't possibly help you as a lawyer. Go to somebody else. He goes to somebody else. You're opening the paper 3 weeks later and you hear in downtown Toronto, people are being kidnapped off the street and they're disappearing. They must be disappearing into a house with a deep basement. Can anybody who knows this notify the police? What do you say?
You can absolutely overcome that. That absolutely overcomes privilege. 100%.
Think so?
Yeah.
Okay. In the United States, it's pretty clear that does not overcome privilege because you don't know specific harm to specific person.
I think it's a tricky area. Let me just give you a story, maybe just getting back.
Please.
This is what I was thinking about. If a client comes to you and says, I got to defeat these creditors, and I need to restructure my affairs so that my assets end up in someone else's name. Okay. And the lawyer says, but I need help doing it because I'm not very sophisticated with these things. If the lawyer actually gives him advice on how to structure it, and I think that if the creditor has a basis for believing a real prima facie basis, that will overcome privilege in court, and you can get production of the information, the evidence of the lawyer, the file of the lawyer, notwithstanding any assertion.
Right, but here, the lawyer said... Right, but... But here, the lawyer said, I'm so sorry, I can't represent you. Please go away. Then I read what indicates to me that maybe this impropriety was done in some way. In the United States, you cannot breach your attorney-client introduction.
This happened to me. People go. And wait, I don't know what happened afterwards. You said, we're not after the end of story. But you know, you're somebody else. And they don't tell the whole story.
And they don't breach. And presumably you never breach.
I never breach.
In that situation.
So I
just want to note the following amazing common law view. What you're describing in Canada and you're describing in the United States is the common law view. Let me tell you who it protects. You know who it protects. Who does this view protect? The lawyer. It doesn't protect society at all, because if we were interested in protecting society, we would mandate breach. To say you can't represent him, but you can't breach, it is at some level the law, the rule that serves lawyers best and society worst. The Jewish tradition looks up and says something very different. It says, if you can breach in a way that protects society, you must do that. The simple answer is, it's bidirectional, but it can always be breached to prevent... Doesn't matter. A rabbi... Absolutely. A rabbi, a lawyer, there's a small medical privilege, spousal privilege, all of these in the Jewish tradition provide the following answer, which the common law views as idiosyncratic. It says as follows. If you can breach in a way that reduces societal harm, you must. But if you can't breach in a way that reduces societal harm, you know what you can do? The transaction. So,
but you never know, because a person may not commit the crime.
So you never, of course, but after you know the crime happens, the normative American law rule is the rule you put forward, which is you still can't breach. Client comes to you and says, I'm contemplating a crime. To commit this crime, I need legal help in doing A, B, C, D, and E. And if you help me do A, B, C, D, and E, I'll be able to do F. I need your help in buying the building next to the bank. You know why I want to buy the building next to the bank? Because I'm going to dig a tunnel from the building next to the bank to under the bank, and I'm going to rob the vault. And you say, I'm not going to do the closing for you on the building next to the bank so that you can dig a tunnel next to the bank and rob the bank. I'd never represent a client like that. So what does the client say? Okay, thank you for your time. Have a good day. They go away. You never hear from them again. 6 weeks later, you open up your National Post, and the lead headline says, amazing bank robbery. Building next to bank bought. Tunnel dug, vault looted. You scratch your head, you open up your files, and you see Joe, with a phone number and a name, came to you to inquire about your helping him buy the bank, and you remember he told you his plan was to dig a tunnel and rob the bank. It's pretty clear to me that in the United States, an amazing result occurs. This amazing result is... You don't disclose.
And if it's a violent crime?
In the United States, the most you can say in violent crimes is, if the violent crime has not yet happened, you can disclose. But if the violent crime has already happened, you certainly cannot disclose. So when a client comes to you,
somebody loose out there who's committed a murder,
right?
There's a chance it could happen again tomorrow.
So you have to make a realistic assessment in American law whether they're a serial murderer or not. Meaning a person who says to you, I want to kill my spouse, you can rest reasonably assured in the laws we now constructed that even after they've accomplished this goal, they don't have any other spouses. So American law requires this reasoning. You know why I'm disclosing the wrong you did yesterday? Because I'm afraid the wrong that you did yesterday is a wrong that you're going to do tomorrow. And there's a famous New York State case involving a very well-known Rabbi Tendler, involving a Mr. Drelich. Mr. Drelich murdered his wife. And he went to Rabbi Tendler pastorally and said, I murdered my wife. Okay. To which Rabbi Tendler did nothing for a little while. And then Mr. Drelich came back one Shabbos morning. You know what Mr. Drelich said? Wish me a mazel tov. And Rabbi Tendler said, how come? And Mr. Drelich said, I'm engaged. So Rabbi Tendler said, mazel tov. And that Sunday morning, he called the police. That's my phone. I'm so sorry. I didn't turn my own little alarm off. That's like... And Rabbi Tendler said, just your rationale. I didn't do anything when Mr. Drelich told me he killed his wife. But when he came to me and said, wish me a mazel tov, I got engaged. I wished him a mazel tov and dropped a dime because now he was endangering the life of wife number two. Maybe. That's a very complicated rationale, though. You'll appreciate how this much it is. It's let's reach the year going the long way to explain to me I can breach for yesterday's crime only when it poses a tomorrow danger. Jewish law is pretty clearly not that way.
You're saying, I'm thinking a way to, going for the Ramah, that I'd rather, you know, it's better for me to take the fee than give it to my neighboring lawyer.
Yes.
Even though I may be involved in a criminal act.
I'll go even further. The Ramah says the best thing to do might be to take a fee and?
Then inform.
Take the fee, and when the crime occurs, or when the crime is about to occur, you might be duty-bound to inform. Because whether you do or don't take the fee is irrelevant to the question of whether you're informing.
Certainly, I mean, you're talking about societal good. I mean, I don't see... I mean, put this way, I don't know. Obviously, if a guy comes into you and says, you know, I'm not going to rob the bank, dig the tunnel, but what happens? He comes to you with a hypothetical. If my friend buys a thing,
The reality is very governing of the parameters of the hypothetical. I 100% understand that. I'm not sure how to handle that problem. But it's clear in Jewish law that what we call the common American model, which is I can't take the fee, but I can't inform on the felon. I have to withdraw in some way. I can't take the fee, and I can't inform on the felon, is at its core a rule that's designed to protect the lawyer, not society, because society really needs you to inform. The Jewish law, I don't have a problem with rules that protect lawyers. The Jewish law view says, according to the Ramah, that the best thing to do is to inform. If for whatever reason you can't inform, then there's nothing wrong with taking the fee. Please.
Denigrating client solicitor privilege as a societal benefit.
You're denigrating client solicitor privilege. That's 100% true.
So, I mean, that's obviously what this is all about. I mean, protecting that privilege for society's benefit.
And okay.
Your way to societal benefit.
But what Rabbi Yisterlitz's comment about all privilege cases is there's a weighing of my duty to stop the wrong and my duty, my right to earn a living. in a situation where we as a society have decided, I don't have to inform, Rabbi Isserles finds it bizarre that I'm still prohibited to take a fee. That his exact point is that when I say, I can't take your fee, but I won't inform, the worst result occurs, which is the malfeasant person learns to do what? Go to the next lawyer, tell him less of the story, give him the fee, and never get caught. This is exactly, I think, the Jewish view. What's interesting, by the way, is when it comes to child abuse, American law, and I'm going to wager Canadian law as well, has adopted the Jewish law view. What do I mean by that? I'm a licensed child psychologist, and I'm treating an adult, and the adult tells me that he has a terrible problem, he abuses children. What do I have to do?
Disclose.
Can I bill him? You betcha. You betcha. I can bill him and disclose his abuse. I don't have to treat him for free and disclose. I can bill him, and when he leaves the office, and he gives me the $175 for a session that he's customarily supposed to do, I will call the police and say, you know, you've been looking for that child molester. I have good news. The good news is he's one of my clients. Exactly, because although we recognize the need for this kind of treatment, in the case of child abuse, as opposed to bank robbery, it's a very fascinating distinction, we recognize that a lawyer can't do things that a child psychologist representing a child abuser can do. A lawyer can never charge a fee and disclose. If the lawyer charges a fee and undertakes the representation, then he's duty-bound almost never to disclose. And if the lawyer declines to take the fee, then he certainly can't disclose. And more than that, at some level, he's made it easier for the criminal to get away with his crime. Because the criminal learns from his first interaction with a lawyer what not to say. When my first lawyer says, I'm so sorry, I can't represent you because you told me you're going to buy this building and build a tunnel into the bank vault and rob the vault, what I learned from this is craft a different story. I like this building so much. It's got just the right front, the right kind of basement. I like the storage facility.
I'll give you a silent.
Please.
There's a law in Canada called proceeds of crime. It's called FinTrack. And the lawyers are become exempt. But the basic obligation, if you're handed a certain amount of cash, that you have an obligation to tell the authorities and an obligation not to tell your client that you told the authorities. So as a...
presumably, though...
Within halakha, is that...
Right, so that's a very fascinating example. And this Jewish law, I think, says that that's the right approach. If my client... Presumably, taking cash from a client is not a crime. Client comes in and he wants to pay you in cash and he's got a lawful source of the cash. Is there anything wrong with that? I don't know.
It's a recording booth.
It's a recording, meaning client comes in and says, here's a gold brick I got from my grandmother. Instead of paying with cash, can I hand you... But you don't know if it's a proceed or a crime. Presumably, you can report it. The government will investigate, determine it's not a proceeds of a crime, and I assume there's no violation by anybody. Is that right? The government has not said cash transactions are illegal. The government just said if you get a large amount of cash, you have to report it to us so we can investigate. FinTrack, in my view, is exactly what Rabbi Isserles means. He says, you're supposed to take the money. And you're supposed to call the authorities. If the authorities arrest your client, so be it.
If we take the approach, we don't accept more than $750 cash for anybody.
Okay, but presumably you wouldn't have that rule if a client could show you a verifiable, lawful source of income. Client comes to you and says, I have an heirloom diamond that my great-grandmother gave to me, and it was a lot of money, and you wanted the business, you'd go through the reporting exercise to I don't know your business at all. Maybe not, maybe yes, but presumably there's no crime in reporting a cash gift. You know, 4 or 5 years ago on Purim, I walked into my rabbi's discretionary fund, and I deposited $14,000 of matanos le'evyonim, gifts for the poor on Purim, in Purim gifts that people had given me in the last 24 hours. And the bank teller says to me, you have to fill out an IRS form if you're going to cash deposit $14,000. You should instead deposit $7,000 today, $7,000 tomorrow. And I said, once you've told me this, I want to fill out the form, because I'm afraid you think I'm your local drug dealer depositing money in a rabbi's discretionary account, and I want to show you that I'm just, in fact, a local rabbi reporting Purim gifts. So I'll fill out the form. You'll send it on to the IRS. The IRS will contact me, and I'll tell them we have this peculiar Jewish custom of giving cash to people to give to the poor, and somebody gave me, a group of people gave me a significant large cash gift. I want to deposit it. And the bank officer came out and said, please don't do this. Please don't do this. If you do this, we'll have to fill out the form. The DEA, the Drug Enforcement Agency, will come here and will have horrible consequences. I said, at this point, I can't back off, because if I back off, you'll think I'm secretly the drug dealing rabbi. And I really want to make sure to you that you understand I'm not a drug dealing rabbi. But I think that Fentrick is an excellent model in the Jewish tradition. Our construct of how we do lawyers is different than how we do almost every other area. Child molesters, we take the money and we report them. Fentrick, we take the money, we not only report them, but we don't tell the client. And when the client gets arrested, we deny knowledge of it. It's a very fascinating, our lawyer's model is incredibly at tension with the Jewish tradition's view in both directions. We think it's not so terrible to represent people committing improprieties when you, the lawyer, are not doing any impropriety, like a house closing on a brothel, while simultaneously we think that there's a duty, when you can, to report clients who are committing crimes. American law, and I'm guessing Canadian law, is the exact opposite. We say you can't do a closing for a client who says, I'm going to open up a brothel here. And we say once you do the closing, you can't report them. This is an exact opposite paradigm. It's so easy for us as lawyers to think that our law model is the only model out there. But the moment you stop and look at other areas of Canadian law, or other areas of Jewish law, you immediately see that both other areas of Canadian law, like child abuse or Fentrick, and I'm sure a dozen other areas, mandate the exact opposite result, and so, in fact, does Jewish law. Please.
It seems to me, with respect, that there's one aspect of this whole discussion that hasn't been mentioned, and that is the problem in Jewish law, Jewish religious law, about giving testimony, albeit true testimony, upon which the court cannot act. For example, one witness of a homicide.
Right.
If he comes along and gives evidence, they'll kill him. Well, don't kill him. They'll be him.
Mm-hmm. So the Jewish tradition thought that the two witness rule, was an ideal, and it accepts as valid, broadly speaking, the Canadian model that you have here, which is courts decide matters of guilt and evidence, guilt and innocence, based on what we would call, broadly speaking, circumstantial evidence, or the testimony of one witness, or one witness plus circumstantial evidence, or totally circumstantial evidence, or testimony of people who are ineligible. The Mishnaic rules of testimony are thought to be an ideal and not a practice. And throughout the centuries, the Jewish tradition functioned based on circumstantial evidence fully and completely, for sure. So I wanted to just give you a food for thought to think about client impropriety. I find, myself for sure, you sometimes get so wrapped up in the laws governing lawyers that you think that they're the only way to do things. And so I've given you both a Jewish alternative model, and not only a Jewish alternative model, but you've provided me with a centric alternative model, and you've also provided me with a child abuse model, which we recognize points in a different direction. So can I ask you a practical centric question from my files? Lawyers are now exempt?
No, wait. We got exempt from the federal government's reporting requirements because they said we're breaching confidentiality. Then the law society just made us do the same thing. So we are, in effect, exempt in one aspect. We still got to report because the law society says we got to report.
Uh-huh.
But you don't
have
to report.
Yeah.
Sure you do.
You do. So
money
that,
diverse, you better get that in.
Yeah, so that's what happened. There was a fight with them.
Uh-huh.
Because
in the United States, the requirement for lawyers is that you may take cash, but if it turns out that the proceeds of your cash are illegal, you're deep in the doo-doo, to use a word that's not supposed to appear on the tape. You can take cash, but if you do take cash and it turns out that the Brinks bag that he's paying you from came from the Brinks arm truck that was robbed yesterday, you're in a heaping lot of trouble. Of course, if you take something like, yes, I'd love to be paid in heroin, now all of a sudden you're going to jail. But even if you take cash bills from a Brinks bag, you yourself run the risk of being an accomplice when it turns out that the money comes from the Brinks job that he's seeking for you to defend him with.
And that's why in America they start seizing lawyers' trust accounts for money. They can't. It's very hard to do that same thing here.
You bet. In the United States, they seize lawyers' trust accounts.
Here they.
Well, so I hope that this was interesting and it provided you with a different framework for thinking about these problems. And thank you very much for coming. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.